You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this episode, we take a deep dive into one of this year's most highly anticipated thrillers, Do No Harm, with the wonderful author Jack Jordan, who also sticks around to talk about our book club book, Fingersmith, by Sarah Walters. We talk to our sponsor, Brighton Fringe, and Hammer and Tongue tell us about their poetry slams. We also talk poetry, motherhood, and IVF with bookseller and writer Erica Gillingham, whose new collection, The Human Body is a Hive, is out now. We have a sponsor this month, and that sponsor is the Brighton Fringe, which I'm really excited about as I'm a huge fan of the Fringe. As a born and bred Brightonian, I feel very proud to have this amazing festival come to our city every year. And I'm back for the first time properly since the pandemic, I believe. So they've jumped on board as this month's sponsor, and I'm really delighted to be joined by Rhiannon from the Fringe to tell us about it. Rhiannon, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
So I'll tell you a little bit about Brighton Fringe. We were here in 2021, but we did obviously have sort of restricted capacities. So we're back this year, hopefully with no restrictions, as long as everything keeps going the way it's going. Brighton Fringe is England's largest open access festival, and we're running this year from the 6th of May to the 5th of June. This year we have over 700 events on sale, so we're really, really excited. We're covering everything and anything this year. We've got 100 venues taking part across Brighton, Hove and beyond. We've got a few out in the countryside, out in Sussex as well this year, which we're really excited about, expanding Brighton Fringe beyond the sort of city limits. We've got comedy, cabaret, music and nightlife, alongside things like circus, and we do have a children's programme, sort of family programme, and of course we've got a fair bit of literature and spoken word. Our daily diaries are now out and about, which we're very pleased about. So they're sort of 100-page booklets outlining what's on and when, so you can grab one of those, or you can buy tickets from our website or download our app. We're really excited about this year. We've got loads of great events on, so ready to get going.
Absolutely buzzing. So it would be remiss of me not to ask about literature at the Fringe. What is happening?
So we have quite a lot of sort of poetry and spoken word this year, including Hammer and Tongue, which will feature Joe, your other guest. We've also got Benke Northern Poetry Takeover, and one I'm looking forward to, which is Two Old Queens and a Clutch of Poems. We also have lots of theatre adaptions this year of classic literature, including The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. And also we've got The Tragedy of Dorian Gray as one of our digital events. They were here in person last year and they did win a Brighton Fringe Award last year. So it's a great thing to catch in the comfort of your own home. And we've even got things like Macbeth musical, and we have lots of children's shows around sort of old literature classics like Alice in Wonderland as well. So yeah, we've got lots on.
Wonderful. What are you particularly excited about this year? Not necessarily literature, just events in general, because sometimes, I mean, it can be really overwhelming. I mean, 700 events is a lot. Obviously, you can't go to all of them. So going on recommendation does seem to be a really good place to start.
Yeah. Well, one of my personal favourites from last year, Simon David White Gay, is coming back to the Comedia this year. So that cannot be missed because it is hilarious and brilliant. But I'm also really excited about the Dutch season this year. So each year we partner with Amsterdam Fringe, Fonds Podium Constant and the Embassy of the Netherlands to bring the best of Amsterdam Fringe to Brighton Fringe. So this year we've got a few different events and workshops that are going to take place at the Old Market, mostly. One of them is going to be at Brighton Spiegelten and another is also going to be at Sweet at the Welly. The shows I'm really interested in are A Pole Tragedy, which is a pole dancing performance based on a Greek tragedy with an interactive pole. So it sort of lights up and there's all sorts of different music. That looks amazing. And then also there's a physical theatre piece by mime duo Deronde Deroux, called After the Echo, which won Best in Fringe at Amsterdam Fringe in 2021, and that's coming to the Old Market. So we're really excited about those shows especially.
An interactive pole dancing group tragedy event is like the most fringe thing I've ever
Exactly.
heard.
That's why I'm so excited. It's, you can't get more Brighton fringe than that.
Absolutely not. So we're really lucky to be joined by Hammer and Tongue on the show, Rhiannon. For you, how do they embody the fringe?
So Hammer and Tongue run poetry slams. I think it embodies the fringe as they engage people from all different walks of life to come and try out poetry. They provide a platform for people. They might be performing for the first time. They might be honing their craft. They might be testing new material in front of an audience for the first time. And they're also open to any style of poetry. So I think that really embodies what fringe is about, trying to really aim to provide a platform for people that might not normally be able to get it. And we're really open to people honing their craft and experimenting with new things. So I think that's why Hammer and Tongue embody sort of the values of the fringe.
Fantastic. So without further ado, let's bring on Joe from Hammer and Tongue. Joe, who, what, why Hammer and Tongue?
So slam poetry is sort of like was an American invention. And there was a working class inventor, a construction worker called Mark Kelly Smith, who sort of wanted to bring the passion back into poetry. So it's poetry with rules, almost. So like there's a couple of things. So can't be over 3 minutes in a poetry slam. You can't use a prop. You can't play an instrument. But 3 minutes puts everyone on the same level, the same amount of time. And immediately afterwards, it's scored. Steve Larkin is the guy who brought Hammer and Tongue to sort of, well, slam, really. He brought slam over to sort of the UK and started up. There's one in Brighton. There's one in Camden, maybe not one in Camden. One in Bristol, definitely. One in Cambridge. And it's been in Brighton for years and years. I'm not actually quite sure which year, but up until very recently, it was run by Michael Parker, who's still very much involved, but he sort of took a step back and asked several other people to run it. It was it's like a gimmick to hang the magic of the night on, which is something my co-host Naomi says that I said, but I don't remember saying. But, I mean, it sounds good though, right?
It sounds really good. You clearly are a poet. Joe, personally, with your background, is poetry something you were always into, or did it come to you when you were a bit older?
So yeah, I've always been into poetry. I used to write like Hilaire Belloc. You know Hilaire Belloc, who did the other day upon the stair, I saw a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Oh, how I wish he'd go away. That was my favourite poem as a child. And then I just wrote things like that, and I was in a band that was almost like spoken word poetry over acoustic pronk, which all sounds made up. But yeah, but genuinely always liked poetry and always been to poetry nights and things like this. But I mean, there's always been loads in Brighton as well, loads of really good ones.
Absolutely. How is it judged?
Okay, so there is five people or five teams of judges chosen from the audience. Our line is the top score is taken off in case that judge is sleeping with the poet. The bottom score is also taken off in case that judge is sleeping with the poet. So yeah, we sort of it's to avoid sort of score creep. So the three middle scores are added together, and that is the score. It's out of 10 with points in the middle. But no one ever really marks anyone below a 5. So it's really out of 5.
That was an unexpected but wonderful answer. You guys are performing at Boat, Brighton's open air theatre this summer. Can you talk a bit about this space and why it's great to perform in?
So I've actually never performed at Boat. But it's open air. I mean, this is the poetry in the open air is it's sort of like I remember seeing Shakespeare up on Hightown Gardens when I was younger, and that was incredible. And that's sort of a similar thing, a similar vibe. And I'm very grateful that they're sort of having us, because it feels like something that's not been done before. An open air poetry slam feels like it hasn't been done before. I mean, it probably has, but we won't look into it.
Joe, I'd love to hear some.
Okay, I mean, I've got I've I've got one called Poetry Night. You hand over the coins to get into the darkened room with a low thrum and an edge that isn't dangerous but promising. You stand in the queue by the door, get a stamp on your hand and plant yourself in a chair with one table next to it. You compose yourself and let the difficult jazz, the wisp-bearded folk music, the unstoppable discotheque mix wash over you as you fill up bottom-up with the same tickly static that fizzy water tastes of. The excitement glues your bum to your seat and you look around to see all the chairs seem to be different sizes and heights. Every person a unique reality in themselves, beaming, frowning, ready and not, poring over notebooks, hushed, excited talk. The hair comes in different heights and sizes too, but there's colours there as well. Colours of the kind that the air will be painted tonight when the hubbub transfers from the crowd to the stage. It feels an age away, but then with no warning, it begins. Our host tonight is a flailing, inflatable tube person with excited vocals, someone with a wit as dry as Velcro, or a local hippie who may or may not include whale song as part of their opening poems. And if that's wrong, then call me using an apostrophe before an S when pluralizing nouns. And let me bathe with the whales and their soulful sounds. You're in. That white noise tickle of butterflies in your stomach hums out your mouth, no longer a trickle, but more of a cheer. You're immediately there, in the moment, and the host explains it, and then you're focused, as they reel you in like a plastic fish on a magnet. You pass the clap, you practice cheering, you're glad that you got a beer in, because this is intense from the off. Hopefully, it will make sense before you take off. And you sit it to hide as they take names of people for the open mic. You're just too shy. What if you get judged harshly by someone? Though, of course, you'll be judging yourself, but into your drink, not into the swelling crowd. And the booming host is the first poet to go, one of their own. You're transported across water to somewhere where words dance like hooligans, anywhere but dance floors, or down through the boards to a past you didn't think you'd be able to see, a myth repainted to fit today, where you're just spinning around on the end of a giant. Close your eyes if you want. Soak it up. Don't forget to applaud, though. Do it just as you begin to wonder where the host ends and the poem begins, and it retracts back into their mouth with a snap like a tape measure. That's when you clap. Thank you very much, they say. And then as the next poet is on the way, someone local will come to warn you, ready for the incoming slam. These words will be like jam to your eardrum toast, which the host toasted and buttered. No muttering here. Silence as you are delivered, fresh into the room delivered, fresh into life and basking in a sliver of light delivered. This poet makes the stage their home, breaks both their legs in the process, but their brain remains uninjured. You've never heard them before, and your jaw hits the floor as they continue their tongue-untied tour of a place you never knew you wanted to be, but now you want to stay. But it's getting late. They need to leave the stage. After all, you should always leave them wanting more. Once again, don't forget to applaud. A break now. A space between acts to absorb that which has befallen you so far. Maybe sneak a cig outside in the cold, talk to any poet you might see, tell them how good it made you feel when they performed, or just sit at your table awaiting your turn, letting the seconds burn up before you can sup from that cup of sweet, sweet poetry again, all while sporting the most enormous frown. Oh, actually, must write that down. Host is back now. You are plunged headfirst into the open mic section, or should I call it headburst, as there's such a vast selection of varying degrees of poet, style, ability, volume. You've got the politically charged preaching to the choir, the obvious lyrics but without the guitar, the wandered in from the street, didn't know it was poetry crowd, who end up wowing everyone with something off the top of their heads. Identities are broken down, intrigue is sown, and for some reason there's a man dressed as a clown who doesn't seem to realise what he's saying isn't funny. Inadvertent idiots, anti-money, humorous poems about lunch, stunt poems like this one that go down like lead balloons, as in they go down brilliantly. Poems about being vegan and weed, some linger in the room longer than others. Some of the poems follow you home, stay with you for years. I still remember the almost gospel shout of England, Middle Fingerland, the terrifying machine gun shot of hope. Don't talk to me about hope. Those bruises in the shape of memories. As for you, you didn't know you wanted it, but your ears are gobbling up the poetry jam straight from the jar now. Like Winnie the Pooh, you're sticky and stuck on poems, high on honey. Drink it up, up, up. wordplay, crowd play, a cappella rap. Even the ones who are rubbish deserve a clap, because they've just done an emotional striptease, taken off their face so you can hear them more clearly and their minds on display. And words are hitting you every which way, but then as sudden as it started. One more break. Intake a slow, measured breath through your nose and you'll be ready to go. This one is much shorter than the last, as they've already blown past 9:30 and people want to get the bus on time. So it's 15 minutes that feels like 4. And then the poems are back on the word floor. We finish with a headliner who gives us every bit of themselves. A shape of them so clear you could reconstruct their skeleton from memory and probably get most of the veins right too. They let you hold their heart in your hand and the passion pumps with a warmth that almost glows. They make you want to be involved. Cynicism is spat like a snake or poems sweet like apples. As clever a chemistry as baking cakes. Every part has the correct weight and the jam from the middle dribbles down your face. This is the state you want to remain in until you need to leave. And that headline act is just handing out their sleeves to everyone, mine still worn on it. Artistry in language, a mystery unveiled. You left breathless at the end, can't catch it back. And for the final time this evening, you must clap and clap and clap until your hands are sore, until there's no more, until the host is back on stage and tells you all to make your way to the door and keep going until you're back once more. A full circle, a round of applause. There we go.
Joe, that was great. That was amazing. For anyone that's interested in poetry in Brighton or the surrounding areas, how can they get involved with Hammer and Tongue?
So Hammer and Tongue is, so slam tickets are available. So on the door, we now do half on the door, half online, because some people can't necessarily get there early to get it on the door, and some people don't have the internet. So you buy a slam ticket and then you're in the slam. You just have to have a poem that's 3 minutes or under that doesn't involve singing. What's interesting about it is it's a sort of a process that feeds itself as well, because the slam, if you win the slam, then you go through to the regional final, which is what is at the Fringe. We're doing it's a regional final. If you win the regional final, you go through to the national final, which is at the Royal Albert Hall. If you win the national final, then not only would you go back and headline at Hammer and Tongues up and down the country, but also you could go on to the international final. If you're in the slam and we like the cut of your jib, then we'd probably ask you to come back and be the opening slot, or I mean, maybe even the headline slot, who knows? But it's like, yeah, anyone and everyone can be in it. So it's, yeah.
I'm blown away by how this works. It's like its own ecosystem. That's amazing. So let's talk about the Fringe, when we've already talked about where and who is going to be there.
Okay. Well, right. So yeah, it's on the 18th of May,
mm-hmm.
which is a Wednesday, and it's between 7 and 9:30. It's one day. It's the regional final. It's who will be the sort of monarch of words in Brighton. It's there. Who will go through and represent us in the national final. I mean, that's very important.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe and Rhiannon. Rhiannon, how can we find and follow The Fringe?
You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Brighton Fringe. You can follow us on Facebook at Brighton Fringe Festival. And the best way to find out about what's on is probably to download our app, and you can make wish lists and see what's going on there. You can search on the App Store or the Google Play Store, just Brighton Fringe, and that's our official app. But you can always go to our website, brightonfringe.org. to find out what's on as well, or you can even give our friendly box office team a call. 01273 917272, I think, double check.
Thank you so much, Rhiannon. And Joe, how can we find and follow Hammer and Tongue?
So on Facebook it's Hammer and Tongue Brighton. There's also an Instagram. There's also a Facebook group, but in person is definitely the best way.
Amazing. Thank you both so much. Poet and bookseller Erica Gillingham joins me in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio. Erica, for anyone that doesn't know you, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Erica Gillingham. I'm a poet and a writer and a bookseller. My primary job is I work at Gaze the Word Bookshop. I would call it the legendary bookshop, a queer bookshop in London. And I also write poetry, which I'll be speaking to you about today, which I'm very excited about. And I write essays. And I'm also have a PhD in young adult literature. Which will also come up a little bit later as well.
Amazing, wonderful. So your new collection has just come out with the Verve Poetry Press, The Human Body is a Hive. Can you talk a bit about this collection and how it came about?
So this collection really started to kind of come together in 2020, which is not necessarily the image we have of that year, but I had started writing many of the poems in this in 2019, and then in 2020, I was approached by Stu at the Verve Poetry Press to submit a pamphlet for their pamphlet series, and really brought this together with the help of some very good friends, including my really good poet friend Farnaz Fatemi, who's in the US. She gave me some great advice on editing. We swapped editing skills, and it was fantastic. So I'm just so glad that it's here.
So this wonderful collection is split into two parts called Pheromones and Honeycomb. Why did you decide to split it into two parts and give them these specific names?
Well, I decided to split the collection into two because I was generating poems that were really along two different themes. One was about love in different relationships, particularly the relationships with women. And the other part was focusing, the other part, kind of part is focusing on our experiences with fertility treatment. My wife and I, starting in 2019, decided to have tried to have a child via IVF. And so there were these two pieces that were working in tandem, and I really wanted to honor both of those parts of my life, but also honor the two different threads that were coming up in my work. A lot of the poems in the first section are quite sexy and engaging and full of desire, but they're also quite playful in different ways. And so pheromones really made sense to kind of nod to that kind of more desire and sexy vibe that was happening in a lot of those poems. And then in the second section, Honeycomb, it was really the attempt to build our family, and to do that through this exchange between our relationship, but also science and nature. I guess the thing I haven't said is that, you know, with the collection being called The Human Body is a Hive, there's a lot of bee imagery that runs through it, and so that was really foundational. And pheromones is how bees communicate in the hive, and honeycomb is the structures they build, obviously.
Absolutely. I'd love you to read a poem called The Gallery Floor, which I particularly loved from the pheromone section of this collection.
Oh, thank you. This is one of my favorite poems that came out of 2020, and it was in response to the then brand new Cypher Press, their call for their first shorts anthology, which was What We Missed because of lockdown. And this is a poem really about friendship, a deep friendship, but also the enjoyment of the arts and what we could no longer do because of lockdown. The Gallery Floor. On days when we'd go to the galleries, I chose my shoes based on their sound against the concrete or hardwood floors. Elegant but hushed, I wanted the day's rhythm punctuated by our companionate shuffle, overlaid by the chatter of the patrons and our cheeky side remarks. Spoken in low tones during the intersection of our orbits, we'd reveal which picture we would hang in our homes, ones that left us besotted, and those we just couldn't care less about. A statement typically followed by a nod and an exit into the next exhibition room. We'd spend time together elsewhere too, but in the galleries, our edges became soft, a lifting only possible with proximity, like birds finding the upwash. My feet barely brushing the floor.
It's absolutely beautiful. I will keep reading that poem and returning to it for sure. I'd love you to read another one as well from the second section of the book called Honeycomb, which has a much more, you're right, kind of scientific feel to it.
Absolutely. And the process of IVF that my wife and I went through not only included donor sperm, but I also myself became a donor, an egg donor. And this is a poem that speaks to that experience. It's called Dear Recipient. As a donor, I sometimes imagine you on my commutes to the clinic, on leafy pavements, in waiting rooms, gently linger on faces as we both may do involuntarily one day at the school gate, the public swimming pool, dance classes, football matches, and birthdays, looking for familiar signs in your child or mine, an interest in the oceans, a talent for writing. Like us, recipients too, for this process to work, you require the donation of a collection of cells by an imperfect stranger whose signature means a radical possibility of new life can begin. I wonder, how many months have you waited for the phone to ring? How often have you startled out of a daydream? How long have you carried your body walking bleary and brokenhearted? Dear recipient, I give you half of what's mine, with every intention of fulfilling your wish for a child, who I hope is every bit as curious about the long, loving story wound within you.
Oh, it's so beautiful, Erica. I'd love to know, as a non-poet, but a real appreciator of poetry, what your process is when you sit down to write.
It can vary by poem to poem, but usually it starts with, particularly with these IVF poems, with a kernel of an idea or a question that I'm ruminating on, and then kind of trying to expand that out in terms of metaphors that are accessible to the reader, to any reader. I think it's really important to make poetry accessible to everyone. And these poems were really engaging, and myself was really engaging with questions about science and nature. And so I was trying to draw on those different specificities within the processes of fertility treatment to explain the emotions that we were experiencing. Yeah. And so I would put down a draft and then I would look to see what was really speaking to me and pull at those different threads and try and illuminate what I felt was most important, whether that was, in this case, the kind of imagery of the children at the school gates and those questions, whether it was, the experience of being in a gallery with my friend, whether it was the Tate Modern or the Royal Academy of the Arts, and trying to capture the sounds or the experiences and fine-tune them as best as possible.
Erica, I'd love to hear what books you are excited about coming in at Gaze the Word this summer and at all local good bookshops.
Oh, absolutely. Support your local indie for sure. And if you happen to be in the Bloomsbury area, Gaze the Word will always welcome you for a hello. Slightly cheekily, I'm very excited because in June I'm going to have a poem published. It's the poem that finishes the collection called Let's Make a Baby with Science. And it's going to be featured in a book that I'm really excited about called 100 Queer Poems. And that's edited by the fantastic queer poets Mary Jean Chan and Andrew McMillan, and features both contemporary work by poets who are working at this moment and are just kind of getting their first books out there, including everyone from the kind of established poets throughout the 20th century, also the well-known poets that we know, Carolyn Duffy, Jackie Kay, etc. And so it's a really exciting collection anthology to be looking at for called 100 Queer Poems that comes out in June. And then this month in May, we've got two novels that I'm really excited about. As I said, I have a background in young adult literature. So Casey McQuiston of Red, White, and Royal Blue and One Last Stop Fame is writing her first young adult novel, but it is definitely for all readers. It's called I Kissed Shara Wheeler. And it is kind of this crazy heist mystery rom-com story set in rural Alabama. It's got great bisexual representation as well as kind of wonderful depictions of non-binary and characters as well, which is just so refreshing to see. And then the final book that I'm really excited about is Tell Me Everything by Laura Kay, which is a lesbian rom-com set in Brighton. I thought your listeners would enjoy that if you haven't already been talking about it. But I'm certainly excited to have Laura's second novel out at the end of May.
Wonderful, Erica. Thank you so much for coming on today, all the way from sunny California. How can we find and follow you?
I've got my website, which is just my name, ericagillingham.com. But primarily, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Erica Reads Queer.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Anna. I really appreciate it.
Jack Jordan is a thriller writer extraordinaire and a relatively recent Brighton resident. His new book, Do No Harm, is out in May. And I am so excited. Excited? I am so excited to have Jack with us in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Jack.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Please, can you introduce yourself?
Of course. So, yeah, so my name is Jack Jordan, and I am the author of five thrillers, soon to be six, with Do No Harm, that comes out on the 26th of May. I started my career as a self-published author and then went into digital publishing after that success. And yeah, I've been going for about 12 years now and continuing to write, continuing to publish. And yeah, it's just a wonderful dream and loving Brighton.
And so we'll definitely go on to that later, what it's like to be a writer in Brighton. But for the benefit of the listener, Jack is terribly, almost disgustingly youthful. So you've been writing, really, Jack, and publishing yourself for quite a long time. Can you talk about, there's a really interesting story that I'd love you to tell, and I think it'd be really inspiring for a lot of our listeners, about when and why you started writing and how you decided to publish yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started writing at the age of 17. I was experiencing agoraphobia. So for about a year, I didn't leave the house. And I've always loved writing and I've always loved reading, but I never saw it as an opportunity for work. I think there's quite a bit of a class barrier. I never made that connection. So when I was experiencing agoraphobia and I was stuck in the house and insomnia came with that and just general anxiety, I started writing to pass the time with no intention of writing a full book, with no intention of it going anywhere, just a short story on my BlackBerry at 5 a.m. to try and get myself to sleep. And then the next day I thought, oh, I'm going to keep writing that. So the next day I started writing and then again and again. And then 6 months later, I looked down and I'd written 100,000 words. And I knew then that was the career path I was going to take. And I think it was a brilliant way to live vicariously through my characters who could live on the outside world. But yeah, it's I wouldn't change it for the world. So that was horrible. It was an amazing way to find what I truly love, which is writing.
And were you always a big reader?
I was, yeah. I think in my teens, it's when he really picked up. I loved it in school, but I think it was when I read Noughts and Crosses by Mallory Blackman for school that my mind opened up to possibilities of storytelling. And it was the first book that truly gripped me that I think about all the time. And obviously I won't say what the ending is, but that haunts me to this day. And it's something that I like to, that feeling, that sucker punch of emotion, I always try and emulate in my own book. So it's really had an effect on me. So yeah, I think, for my teenage years, I've been a little bit obsessed with reading.
And so after writing on your BlackBerry, which is such a throwback, by the way, and amazing that you must be so dexterous, because I can never, my thumbs are always too like big for those tiny letters. So you decided to self-publish your work, which is a huge feat in itself, because when you self-publish a book, you need to become
everything, a kind of editor, a designer, a publicist, a marketer, you know, a champion for your own book. Can you talk a bit about that process and how you learned to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what a lot of aspiring writers will relate to is that it's really hard to get into this industry. And I'm a little bit impatient. So after 3 years of consecutively writing novels and submitting them and not getting anywhere, I decided, OK, well, there was this boom of self-publishing going on at the time. And I thought, OK, well, I'll do that. I'll give that a go. If this way isn't working, I'll work my way through on self-publishing routes. So in 2015, I self-published my debut novel, Anything for Her. And it was actually, it was an amazing experience because I learned so much about the business, because I think what's is you don't expect as a writer, you think about the story, you think about what we love about it, but then there's the other aspect which is really important to grasp, is a business. So understanding the ins and outs of that process, the marketing, the editing, the proofreading, building contacts in that way, it was really, really informative, and set me up really well for when I entered traditional publishing, because I could kind of know what each department did, I knew what my expectations would be, and also I came to the industry with a lot of skills that they could utilize as well, and it was lovely to have a sense of control, to be honest. I think it's in publishing, a lot of writers can tend to feel that you kind of hand over your book baby and hope for the best, whereas with self-publishing I found that I could was in complete control to do with what I wanted with it.
And they did really well. You were an Amazon bestseller and subsequently got picked up by a publisher for your next two books, is that right?
So Anything for Her and My Girl, my first two novels that I self-published, I was very lucky that they sold 100,000 copies. So from that success, I then had HarperCollins approach me, which I didn't expect. And it's not the linear way to do it. You're meant to go submit agent publisher, but it was going the wrong way around. So I remember being really excited and then panicking and emailing agents being like, help me, I can't broker this. So I got an agent and I ended up signing with another publisher for my next three books, two which were paperback and one which was an ebook short, starting with Before Horizon 2018 and Night by Night in 2019. And that was, again, that was like an independent publisher. So that was another bit of experience of the industry I got, because they're all quite different, from self-publishing to independent publishers to the big five, or how many there are now, big four. So lots of, learned so much. And then that led to signing with Simon & Schuster in 2020.
Which is so exciting. And you are a lead title for them. And for anyone that doesn't know, a lead title is a book that every year a publisher has a certain amount of books that they can really pump all of their energies into. And my gosh, are they pumping their energy into Do No Harm. You must firstly be exhausted, but secondly, it's kind of the dream for many authors.
The absolute dream. It's, this whole experience has been everything I've ever dreamed of and dared not to dream of sometimes, because it's just such an amazing experience and I feel tremendously lucky. And I think it's actually lovely that, I mean, this is my sixth book this has happened to. So I like to think that it's, it can be inspiring to anyone who their debut novel didn't do well, or they, in this industry, there's a bit of an obsession with sales track record, and you're only as good as your last book sales. And if that tanks, then you're not going to get more success or opportunities. And I think I like to think that my career is proof that that isn't the case. I've had great sales, I've had not so great sales, I've had great experiences, I've had not so great experiences. And yet, I've now been given this opportunity with Do No Harm to live this dream and this experience. And it's so funny, actually, because so I started writing Do No Harm 10 years after I started writing. It was kind of a really weird parallel experience where, so when I started writing, I was agoraphobic and couldn't leave the house. And I started writing Do No Harm during lockdown and couldn't leave the house. Yeah. So it was amazing, kind of almost therapeutic experience. And I was going through a process of, I'd left my former publisher. I'd parted ways with my agent. It was a real starting over moment in my life, in my career, a real crossroads. And then with this book, I was able to land my dream agent, Madeline Milburn. And then got the, went to auction, which was really exciting, and signed with Simon & Schuster. And it's been such a dream ever since. And if you told me when I was without a publisher and without an agent, and in a pandemic, that this would happen, I would have laughed until I was blue in the face. So what I love about that story is that anything can happen. Nothing's off limits as long as you continue to go for what you want.
Absolutely. And keep writing and keep working on your craft. So let's talk about Do No Harm, Jack. What is this book about?
So Do No Harm is about a heart surgeon, Dr. Anna Jones, whose child is abducted by an organised crime ring, and they give her an ultimatum. Either she has to kill a patient on the operating table or she'll never see her son again. So it's a real look at this moral dilemma, an almost impossible choice that I've put her in, where she has to either choose her heart as a mother or go against her Hippocratic oath or obey that. So yeah, it's a real moral dilemma that the readers get to sink their teeth into. It was so much fun to write.
How did you come up with this idea? Because I'm sure anyone listening can really sense that you are kind of have a wonderful, bright energy about you. But oh my gosh, Jack, the books you write are so dark.
I think, yeah, you know, a lot of thriller writers are actually really, really lovely, and it goes against everything they write. and I think that's because we get to pour our dark imaginations into the pages and live vicariously through our evil characters, but we'd never do it in real life. With Do No Harm, I had a medical procedure, and I had to be put under anaesthesia, and I hadn't had that for a long, long time. So I kind of forgot about the kind of scary aspect of it. So just as I was about to be wheeled in and they were just about to put the needle in, I suddenly thought to myself, I don't know anyone in this room. I don't, anything can happen. I'm completely trusting them in my welfare. And I really panicked. And then, I was put under and everything went well. But when I woke up, albeit a bit groggy, in the recovery room, I began to write my notes thinking, well, what would have happened if the consultant's oath had been jeopardised, or what if their intentions were a little bit darker? So it was kind of from that real experience that went really well, but it sort of created that idea of, well, what if it didn't go well? What position could I put that surgeon in to make them go against their oath? So I find that fascinating.
Absolutely, absolutely. Jack, you are going to read an extract to us. Where does this part come into the book?
So this is a nice short reading. This is when Dr. Anna Jones has just walked into her house to find the organised crime ring within it. So she's just found out that they have taken her son, and she's been given that ultimatum. Either she kills the patient or she loses her son. I sit in the armchair before the men, frozen in place. For a brief second, everything stops. My mind is wiped clean. My heart stalls with a painful jolt. Air catches in my lungs, and then it all comes crashing back. I inhale a desperate guttural breath as tears bite at my eyes. This isn't real. It can't be. Dr. Jones, I need you to focus. This is important. I nod obediently, a single tear falling silently towards my jaw. Your son is in a safe place, and no harm will come to him if you do as we say. There are rules you must follow, and if you break them, your son will pay the price. This man, this stranger, is using my own tricks against me. He's employing the same tone I use when I tell a patient's next of kin that they have died, sympathetic yet firm. I'm sorry for your loss. All you have to do is complete one simple task and you will get him back unharmed. My heart leaps so fast and violently that a pain slices across my chest. A task? I ask, my voice hoarse with fear. You must kill Ahmed Shabir on the operating table in 2 days' time. My stomach drops. I'm going to be sick. My vision is swirling. I grip onto the arms of the seat and push the heels of my feet into the carpet in the desperate need to root myself. If you repeat this to anyone, your son will die. If you at any point discovered in this assignment, your son will die. If you fail to kill the patient, your son will die in his place.
The book is deeply tense, and it's not a short book by any means. There's probably a good 300 or 400 pages there, Jack, but I whipped through this one. I also now have kind of like quite a deep sense of paranoia that my flat has been bugged, because obviously I'm trying to make myself the main character in every story. So Do No Harm is told from three points of view. We've got the we've got Dr. Anna Jones, then we've got the someone who works with her at the hospital called Margot, and then we have a woman from the police or a detective who is trying to uncover a murder around that is connected to the story. Why did you decide to have three narrators?
Really good question. So I do really like the idea of having multiple points of view, because it's a great way as a writer to keep up that suspense and tension when you jump from perspective to perspective. But what I loved about the characters that I chose for this is that each of them are at different stages of motherhood. So with Dr. Anna Jones, her son has been abducted and she's got to do anything she can to save him. Then we have Margot, her scrub nurse, who has recently found out she's pregnant, and she's in a really dire situation of owing debts and just a really, really bad place. So she's also propelled to do whatever she can to survive. And then we have Detective Inspector Rachel Connolly, who lost her child years before and is in that grieving process. So during this story, we have to, with Detective Rachel Connolly, she is investigating this murder and soon finds out that there's a link between this missing boy, which is Dr. Anna Jones's son. So she becomes a little bit obsessed with Dr. Anna Jones, trying to find out the truth. And obviously Dr. Anna Jones has to protect that her son isn't missing, because otherwise she could lose him forever if it's discovered. So what I loved having those almost parallels between those characters, particularly with the detective and the surgeon, because if Dr. Anna Jones doesn't get her son back, her life could pretty much emulate the detective's, who's living in grief, who didn't get to save her child, who is, you know, living in misery because of this experience. So it's kind of almost a telling of the future if Dr. Anna Jones doesn't get what she needs to get to.
Absolutely. It really, really raises the stakes. Something that I've really noticed in your writing, Jack, is how female protagonists and women are really centered in your thrillers. Quite a common trope for thrillers is that there is a dead body in them and it's normally a woman's. And I'm not saying that that's not something that you do in your books, but you definitely really center female voices. Is that something that's conscious? Why is it that female voices are centered in your writing?
I don't really know what the psychology is, but I've always thought writing from a woman's perspective. I mean, I was raised by women, my mum and my grandmother, and my friend Min, all the books I read are usually by women. So I've got this real affinity with women. And I've always felt more comfortable. So I'd love to know what the psychology is behind that. Maybe it's a non-binary thing, I'm not quite sure. So I've always felt more comfortable. And I think you're totally right that there is this usual trope where women are used as a plot point for violence rather than their actual experiences or their actual human traits. and I think that's something that is really important, particularly for male writers to focus on. If you're going to write by women, do know women, do read women. I've always just had an affinity with it.
I really like playing this game with authors of multiple books, where I read out the titles of the books and I ask the author to give their elevator pitch. So we're going to play this now with your previous book, Jack. How does that sound?
Very good. If I'm rusty with the beginning ones, I do apologise.
It was a long time ago. Okay, let's start with Anything for Her.
Oh, you start me off at the beginning. So Anything for Her is about the story of a mother and daughter who committed a crime in the past, and it's coming back to haunt them. So someone is stalking them and someone knows what they did. So they've got to hide it from everyone else that they know, but hope to get away with it. But then the daughter goes missing.
Oh, how about My Girl?
My Girl is about a mother whose child was abducted, and she's living in that grief and aftermath. And then she discovers a secret about what happened to her daughter.
A woman scorned.
Told from four people's perspectives, it follows a single day where we learn from each perspective what happened that day and how the characters interlink. There's an affair in there that burns everyone else's lives to the ground.
Oh, exciting. Before Her Eyes.
Before Her Eyes is about a blind woman who stumbles across a body with the killer still at the scene, and then she becomes his next obsession.
Oh my gosh. Night by Night.
Night by Night is about mother who's experiencing insomnia, who caused an accident, which caused a huge rift within her family. And then, so we meet her, that's how we meet her at the beginning of the book. And then she finds a journal written by a man who writes of being stalked and fearing for his life. And when she goes to the police and they don't take it seriously, she begins to investigate herself.
Oh my gosh. You did very well on that because I didn't prepare you for that one. Well done. Up next, we are going to talk about Sarah Walters's Fingersmith, which is a book that you recommended to me, Jack, and kindly bought me for Christmas this year. And I really wanted to talk about it on the show because we often have a tendency to choose kind of new and forthcoming books. And this is a book that is a kind of classic in the canon of LGBT historical books. So what I'm going to do is read the blurb and then we're going to have a chat about it. Sound okay?
Yeah, sounds brilliant.
London, 1862. Sue Trinder, orphaned at birth, grows up among petty thieves, fingersmiths, under the rough but loving care of Mrs. Suxby and her family. But from the moment Sue draws breath, her fate is linked to that of another orphan growing up in a gloomy mansion not too many miles away. Jack, why Fingersmith?
I mean, I love Sarah Walters, but Fingersmith in particular, it's just got, I think, everything that I would ever want in a book. It's both commercial in sense of pace and suspense, but also literary in terms of setting and character growth. It's just got everything in there. So LGBTQ plus, it's historical, it's also a little bit crime, female led. And I think as a writer, what I really, really admire about it is a masterclass in decepting your readers. You think you know what's going to happen, and then she pulls the rug out from under your feet in the most spectacular way. I remember when I pitched it to you, Anna, when I bought it for you and said you have to read it, that there is a part in the middle of the book that just changes the entire narrative. And it just, I remember it was, again, that like sucker punch of emotion that I felt with Noughts and Crosses as a teenager, that feeling, a crave of being shocked. And it's just absolutely amazing.
And there's something about Victorian Britain.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's like Dickinson's London and...
Yeah, like grimy and kind of... gross, but like kind of weirdly sexy at the same time.
yeah, there's a character in there who runs around, I think barefoot, around London in a really precarious situation, and you just capture the whole of Victorian London in this very tense scene. And yeah, it's grimy, it's scary, you know. I don't think women were meant to be on their own in the streets, yeah. Or not meant to have their heads not covered, or you know, so many, I think the cultural aspects of the time as well, it's so fascinating to look into.
Absolutely. And it's kind of deeply feminist at its heart. And I loved that about it. I really did.
Totally. I think with the landscape of how it's so hostile towards women, but then it shows very strong female characters that are very young as well, kind of surviving in these really dangerous worlds they find themselves in, even though they're quite polar opposite. I mean, I think it was amazing to kind of look into that kind of baby farming era where, you know, there was like loads of babies in the attic. And yeah, it's just, and how like Sue has to steal to survive, and how they've been taught to be deceptive and cheat one another. And actually within that, there's actually a heart that comes out, and the goodness that they've had to kind of shove down in order to survive comes through when they meet, which I just think is really beautiful.
Absolutely. If this is your first Sarah Walters, what would you move on to next?
The Paying Guest is equally brilliant. So I read Fingersmith first and it blew me out the water. And I thought, how am I going to read another one of hers? Because they can't be any, you know, you can't beat that. And then I read The Paying Guest, which is another fantastic book. And that is set in, I believe, the 1920s, the 1930s. So still historical, still LGBTQ+, still very feminist. It's about a woman and her mother who take in a couple as lodgers, and basically how their relationships kind of come together and implode. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us on the Brighton Book Club. I only have a couple more questions for you. I would like to know what you do when you're not writing or reading in Brighton.
Very good question. At the moment, I'm a bit of a workaholic, so that doesn't really happen. But occasionally I will, I'll go down to the beach and read, or I will meet up with friends for dinner. I met up with my great friend called Anna Burt for dinner last night. and yeah, I mean, Brighton's such a fun place. It's especially for creative people. So many places to go for cocktails, so many places to go for dinner, so many events to go to. I'm really looking forward to Brighton Fringe coming back. That'll be so much fun. That it just feels like that, you know, summer's arrived when you get to see all these amazing creative things on stage every night if you want to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Jack, if anyone's listened to this and thought, oh my gosh, I need to see this man live, I want to get my copy of the book signed, you are having a launch in Waterstones. When is it and how do we get tickets?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So I'm so in Waterstones, Brighton, there is a launch on Tuesday, 24th of May. So you'll get it if you come 2 days early, because it's not published until the 26th on Thursday. And I'm in conversation with Nadine Matheson, author of The Jigsaw Man. And yeah, we're just going to have a really good celebration of the book and I'll be signing. And if you do want to pre-order yours, there's a special edition through Waterstones that you can pre-order now. And it's got sprayed edges with an amazing heart monitor line stamp on the side. It's absolutely cool. So brilliant.
Oh, sprayed edges is the dream for any author. Jack, thank you so much. How can our listeners find and follow you and especially see, a little birdie tells me that you're about to go and see the book being printed and post it all over social media. So how can we see that?
Yeah, I'm so excited for that. So yeah, so if you want to follow me on Instagram or TikTok, it's JackJordan_author, or on Twitter, I am JackJordanBooks.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jack, and good luck with the publication of this wonderful book.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to celebrating with you on the 24th of May.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. Our next episode is a Summer Reads special, and we'll be talking to Laura Kay amongst some other fab writers with books out this summer, as well as hearing about the very exciting Brighton and Beyond anthology, which I'm honoured to have worked on. Our next book club book is Dolene Perkins Valdez's Take My Hand. Montgomery, Alabama, 1973. Fresh out of nursing school, Sybil Townsend has big plans to make a difference in her community. At the Montgomery Family Planning Clinic, she intends to help women make their own choices for their lives and bodies. But when her first week in the job takes her down a dusty country road to a tumble-down cabin, she's surprised to find that her new patients are just 11 and 13 years old. Neither of the Williams sisters has even kissed a boy, but they are poor and black, and for those handling their welfare benefits, that's reason enough to have girls on birth control. As Sybil grapples with her new responsibilities, she takes India and Erica into her heart and comes to care for their family as though they were her own. But one day she arrives at their door to discover the unthinkable has happened, and nothing will ever be the same. The Book Club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at btmbookclub and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. If you are interested in sponsoring an episode, get in touch and we will see you next month.
depression.